Diana, tell us who you are.
My name is Diana Mosquera, and I am an anesthesiologist at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania and a second-year MBA student at Wharton.
So, as anesthesiologist, what do you do?
So, my day-to-day job is to go into the hospital operating rooms and provide anesthesia for patients that are having surgeries. During this COVID-19 pandemic, my job has also shifted to responding to all the airway emergencies, which basically means patients that need to be placed on ventilators. I'm the person that goes and places them on ventilators.
Today, Anush and I are doing something different. There's been a lot of coverage in the news about COVID-19 and the government's response. However, we very rarely hear from the frontline workers themselves. We're so lucky to have someone in our Wharton class who's both an MBA as well as an attending physician at Penn Med. Anush and I went back and forth a few times debating whether to do an interview related to COVID-19 because we just weren't sure what would really add to this conversation outside of what we've already seen and heard. Realizing that one of our classmates was on the front line and that we rarely get to hearing directly from the doctors and nurses who spend their time fighting fires, we thought having a conversation with Diana would provide a really unique perspective on the current crisis.
Diana, thanks so much for being here.
No problem. I'm happy to be here.
We want to be respectful of your time, so we're going to go ahead and dive right in. First question, tell us a little bit about how you are spending your days. You're both a full-time MBA student and a practicing physician on the front lines of this crisis. How are you balancing both commitments?
So basically, life pre-COVID-19, I did my residency at Penn, and I had the privilege of joining the faculty as an instructor for the past 2 years while being in school full-time. So that really allowed for my work schedule to accommodate my academic duties. So what that translates to day-to-day is that I've been able to work 1 to 2 days a week whenever school is in session and work more days whenever we have holidays, breaks, et cetera. During the COVID response, my department asked for volunteers to staff COVID units or COVID ICUs as we were seeing new data come out and models saying that we could potentially run out of capacity, et cetera. So I volunteered. I emailed my professors to let them know, and they were extremely supportive. So I want to just shout out professors Claudine Gartenberg, Anup Menon, Paul Fisher, who all responded to me right away and basically said, you know, do what you need to do, which for me took a huge load off my back to be able to really just shift my focus into just thinking through as a clinician how I would prepare myself if I needed to go in and be in the ICUs or staff. That was my main concern was, you know, how do I prepare myself to take care of these patients? There's a big difference between the ICU and the operating room. You know, I trained at Penn, so, you know, I have great training. I was able to familiarize myself with the ICUs there. But day-to-day in the operating room is a more controlled environment. Even if patients are really sick, you have more control of what's going on than if you have a patient who is in the ICU, requires more intensive care for a prolonged period of time. It's just a total different experience. So I spent several days refamiliarizing myself with the ICU environment, ventilators in the ICU. Luckily for me, Penn did set up an educational website where I was able to basically go through modules aimed at non-ICU trained anesthesiologists who would be able to staff ICU units if needed to care for these patients. I guess the punchline is that, you know, each phase really comes with different challenges. And what it feels like, I think, and I'm assuming this is what it also feels like for people in leadership positions, is it's almost like you're building the plane while in the air. And, you know, we're still in the air, but we just need a different plane. We need to adjust the plane to take care of whatever is coming in the coming weeks and months.
Diana, really, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And you started to touch on a bit of this, but would love for you to talk us through what one of your busier days in the hospital has looked like, hour by hour. What is it that you are doing and what is it that's sort of demanding your attention?
Yeah, so essentially kind of like the way that things have worked in the hospital, at least the way that I experienced them, is that once the crisis started, we established an airway team, which is basically on a any regular day, you go into the operating room, you're staffing cases, and there's someone who is an anesthesiologist who is part of the team that responds to any patients that need to be placed in ventilators. For this crisis, because we're expecting an overwhelming number of patients, we created a separate airway team, which is basically a team that's solely responsible for responding to patients in respiratory distress that need to be intubated, placed in a ventilator. Mm-hmm. And these are teams that, we cover these shifts in 12-hour shifts, 24/7. Okay. So for me, every time I'm in the hospital, when I hear the overhead anesthesia stat call, which is basically calling that airway team, my heart really just goes out to that patient, that patient's family. You think mm-hmm. about the colleague that you know is going to be exposed to the virus. In particularly, I'd like to just sort of, highlight, my first airway shift was really stressful because even though I do airways all day, I've been doing mm-hmm. this for years now, you're concerned about making sure that you put on and take off your protective equipment correctly. Mm-hmm. Because we know that the virus spreads, especially what we saw the data coming out of Italy and coming out of other places that sort of were leading in dealing with this crisis, is that that's how you sort of contaminate, the virus spreads when you just contaminate yourself or other patients, touch things. But then all of a sudden that takes a back seat because, you have a really sick person in front of you. You need to focus on how are you going to intubate them safely and efficiently? What kind of equipment do you need to have in the room? What medications, you take into account their medical history. And then emotionally you're thinking, you may be the last person that this patient sees and you do everything you can to comfort them. Especially, if they're awake enough to talk to you. I remember, my first patient, this patient was trying to text their mom for 15 minutes as we're in the room geared up wearing PPE. And I made the decision. I was, the person leading that team, and I made the decision to just stay in the room with my PPE on until my patient finished texting, because I felt like that was the right thing to do, to allow this person to at least feel a little bit of peace, a little bit of control before, being placed on a ventilator. And the other sort of parts of my day, when I go in and I'm not in the airway team, I'm just keeping the ORs running. There's patients that really can't delay surgeries. They are sick from other things and need to be in the hospital. And you really mm-hmm. want to, my job is really keep those patients safe. I wear my PPE with those patients. I wear gloves. I make sure I'm keeping my hands clean. And for those days, I go in, at 7 a.m. And then, we leave whenever we're done with our cases.
I can imagine that after so many weeks of this on a weekly or daily basis, there must be a lot of mental strain that medical professionals start to take. Would love to know from you how you've personally managed this and how you found your colleagues to take care of their own mental health as they attend to people in the hospitals.
That's a great, great question. We need to process the grief, the stress during that, everyone that's responding to this crisis. I have some colleagues who haven't seen their kids or their partners because they're concerned about exposing them to the virus. That must be really, really tough to deal with as well. One anecdote that I always think about now is about a month ago, I was listening to a podcast coming out of Italy and the crisis in Italy, and it broke my heart. I remember people would say, at some point you just heard ambulances. And now I actually, every time I hear an ambulance siren when I'm at home, it's just I've never, that sound just took on a completely different perspective now. The hospital system, Penn set up a lot of resources for frontline providers to, have mental health support. There's resources, financial resources for people who are in, need financial, they set up grants for people that, need a little help. Personally, I have found that having clear communication from my department and from the health system has actually been really helpful from a mental health standpoint, because it just gives you that sense of control, at least you know what's happening, or at least to the best of your knowledge, you're up to date. I have reached out to friends from residency. We kind of went through the battle that is residency together, mm-hmm. and we're very mm-hmm. tight. And I set up these office hour happy hours. Every Friday, we log into Zoom at 8 p.m. and we just, we're all over the country now. And, some of my colleagues are in New Jersey, staffing ICUs there. And we just chat and talk about how the day is going. Also talk to some people at work currently and just sort of go into work and chat with them, see how they're doing. Warden has been extremely supportive. I mean, I've had classmates, text me during Zoom meetings, to say thank you. And that really warms my heart. I've had classmates reach out to me just to see how I'm doing, which has been really nice. I actually, when this kind of started about a month ago, I was talking with my executive coach. And I remember that was supposed to be our last session. And the entire session we spent essentially talking about, okay, Diana, we know how your leadership style, we know what you're like, how are you going to manage? How are you going to cope with being placed in a new environment if you get pulled into the ICU? How are you going to lead that team? What are some of the expectations to have of yourself?
That's fantastic to see the school kind of flex up its resources to support people like you who are on the front lines. From our position, hear a lot of stories about hospitals that lack resources to support their care staff, from basic PPE to more advanced kind of life-saving devices. And we've even heard of situations where care professionals have had to make decisions on who gets access to this equipment. If you're open to talking about it, can you share with us an experience that you might have had where you've had to make a decision such as that, where you have to prioritize one patient over another?
So fortunately, I have not had to go through that. I will preface that by saying that I am in a completely unique situation because there's only so many pen medicines around the country. Pen medicine is really, you're talking about the top in terms of resources, in terms of really that's what it comes down to, what resources you have, how you can, deploy those resources. We haven't had, I haven't experienced any issues with shortages of PPE. We've also are in Philadelphia, and we've been lucky in Philadelphia where we've had a curve that has been flatter than what we experienced. So thank you to all of you guys who are at home, social distancing, everyone that took this seriously, because that really was the difference between a hospital system in a city being totally overwhelmed and being able to manage with what we have and make those resources and have those resources really have the most impact. I haven't had to make those decisions. I can't imagine how difficult those decisions are to make from everyone involved and how you move forward after that.
You shared a little bit of insights on the response at Penn Med. What do you think it is about the Penn Med hospital system and specifically the hospital that you're working at that has allowed it to be so well prepared for this pandemic?
I mean, I'm not an expert, so I'm not sure that my answer is necessarily valid, but just from a subjective perspective, what I see is that, we, from a logistics standpoint, our curve sort of came after the New York curve. So I think that we saw what was happening there, that, New York was really the front in terms of cities that were sort of going through this. They kind of went through it first, and just seeing that, I think, helped us understand from a policy planning standpoint, citywide, what to do in terms of shutting down the city, making the stay at home order. And then from a health system view, I think, it probably gave people the chance to really think through how we were going to deploy PPE and how we were going to do all that. I know that the system also started, we had to wear masks all the, for weeks now. We'd be going in wearing masks. Getting into Penn is super hard because they take your temperature. Every person that goes in through the doors, they take your temperature. Visitation, patients, have to be, you can't visit patients basically because we're trying to really limit the exposure of healthcare workers. And I think, what allows Penn to do that is it's a complex network that, of leadership resources. It's kind of if you're someone depending on what resources you have access to, that kind of also dictates your outcome.
Dana, we've started to talk about this, but we've been looking at COVID-19 tracking project data. And exactly as you said, we see that Philly is estimated to be past its peak in terms of deaths and hospitalizations. Of course, without asking you to look too far into the future and acknowledging how busy it must be up until this day, what is the sense from the frontline workers about when hospital systems will have a more manageable stream of patients?
You know, my sense is generally informed by what's actually happening more on like the macro perspective. Because I think like understanding that guide, you know, what guides that timeline to reopening really just requires a macro perspective and also thinking about county level data that you're getting and the quality of that data. You know, what we see at Penn, what we're seeing one hospital, it really doesn't reflect what's happening across the city. I can't speak to what Temple's going through, what Jefferson's going through, what Einstein's going through. They may be going through a completely different experience. You know, as we mentioned, you know, Philadelphia's been lucky, you know, social distancing has helped us flatten the curve. And also, you know, I don't know if you guys know this, but our health commissioner, Dr. Thomas Farley, actually worked in the CDC's Epidemic Intelligence Service for almost a decade.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
yeah,
interesting.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, having him and having our political leadership sort of work closely with scientists has, I think, really mm-hmm. been helpful for us as a city. You know, my understanding of what's going on just comes from reading the news, looking at the, you know, epidemiological models, you know, just thinking about what the number of cases that we need to have daily to allow the city to reopen. You know, we're still, I think, far from those number of cases, but I know that, you know, even though our curve has peaked or maybe flat, we still, you know, we're still far from having that like low enough number of cases to move forward safely into easing precautions. Because, you know, you're concerned about what happens if there's a second wave, then you kind of undo all the hard work that everyone has been doing for the last, you know, month or more than that. And so, you know, in addition, you know, when you think about treating COVID patients, a lot of these patients, the ones that end up on ventilators, they're on ventilators for, you know, for 4 weeks, even more, you know, more mm-hmm. than a month. And so when you're thinking through, you know, when can we reopen, when can we go back to normal, you kind of think about the high resource need that's sort of required even after the storm. And how do you plan for that?
Right. You know, we're seeing so much data on the disparity of treating COVID, the disparity with respect to recovering from the disease, and the disparity seems to be very closely connected to sort of race and socioeconomic status. From your position on the front lines, can you share a bit more context from your end? And what sort of holes do you think this has exposed in the healthcare system more broadly?
There's so many ways that, you know, we can approach disparities. And, you know, specifically you're thinking through COVID, you're thinking through what happened in New York City. So, you know, I'll tell you, you know, how I have experienced and processed these disparities through sort of my personal story and my experience.
For some context, I'm an immigrant. I was born in Colombia. I moved here 20 years ago. My dad was an accountant in Colombia.
He didn't have resources, support, time. He gave up his career around age 40 to work as a parking attendant and a janitor in New York City. You know, doing that really allowed him to support our family and allowed me to go to public school, go to college. And so when New York City, my dad still lives in New York, when New York City started experiencing, you know, the surge in COVID cases, you know, I try to get my dad some time from work, off from work, because, you know, my dad was in that demographic that I knew, like I'm reading about this and I'm looking at my dad and I'm saying, okay, so my dad is living in New York City. He has pre-existing conditions that make him vulnerable to, you know, moderate to severe COVID symptoms, which is really, you know, the more critical part. And those conditions, are, you know, high blood pressure, diabetes, things like that, that we know from a, you know, from historical, in just like looking at our health, public health data, are more prevalent in certain communities of color. However, you know, those are conditions that really, you know, made him vulnerable, but because my dad's an essential worker, you know, it's complicated because, you know, he felt the duty to keep going to work, you know, to right. be there for his team. So, you know, he's a maintenance worker in a residential building in Chelsea. you know, he wasn't sort of in the thick of things and he just couldn't have that time off. And then about 4 weeks ago, he called me with symptoms. You know, he said, I think I have a cold. And immediately, you know, I was like, oh man, I think this may be COVID. And I started talking to my friends and they're like, you know, hope for the best, right? Mm-hmm. You know, my dad lives in Corona, Queens. He lives alone. His nearest hospital is Elmhurst Hospital. You know, he takes a 7 train to work every day. You know, I was on him. I was saying, Dad, wear your mask. He had an N95 from work. He had gloves. And I was like, just wear that, all, you know, as much as you can, wear all the time. And that's what he did. But, you know, he couldn't stay home. So he's still, you know, being exposed. You know, his risk of exposure was high.
Right.
And then, like, yeah, and like 3 days after that initial call, you know, he started getting short of breath. And at that point, I really just had to make a really tough decision. I was like, you know, I need to go to New York. I need to pick up my dad. Because I said, you know, my husband, I was like, this is like when New York City was like peaking in cases. And I was like, if something happens right. to my dad, like, you know, I knew from just like looking at the signs, like people can become severely ill in a very short time. So I felt like I had a very small window to just like rescue him and just literally take him out of New York City.
Wow.
You know, and like my dad speaks, you know, he speaks conversational English, but he's not fluent. So I knew, you know, there's going to be a language barrier there. I knew New York City was overwhelmed. You know, there's a real chance that, you know, if my dad went into the emergency room, he may end up on a ventilator. You know, so, you know, my husband and I geared up, we put on all our PPE. Luckily, you know, we have N95 masks, we have gloves, we have gowns. So we literally just dressed up, got in our car and drove down to New York City to pick up my dad.
Wow.
Yeah, we drove back on the highway with our windows down. It was, interesting.
Oh my experience. Goodness.
I mean, we were just trying to do everything because I was like, I'm still working. I need to protect myself for my patients, but I also want to help my dad. So I was just like, okay, sure. let's do this, you know, as best as we can. And, you know, luckily for me, you know, I didn't get sick. My husband didn't get sick. We were able to bring my dad here to my place. I have a room. I had a room with like a bathroom that was basically allowed him to really self-isolate for 2 weeks. So for 2 weeks, I didn't see my dad. I just left his meals outside his door. You know, I checked in with him by FaceTime. I would call him. My dad lost about 21 pounds. He says that there are several days where he was too weak to even get out of bed. And he's doing better now. He's back in New York. But he's still trying to regain strength. He's trying to gain weight. You know, he still has a mild cough. He was lucky that he was able to get 2 weeks off paid leave, but, you know, he still had to take 2 more weeks without pay just to recover, to get, you know, get the strength back to go back to work. So, I mean, I guess what I've reflected from that is, you know, my dad, my family, and I, we've been lucky. You know, if COVID happened to us, you know, 20 or 10 years ago, we would have all been sick because 4 of us lived in a 1-bedroom apartment in Queens. And that is the experience that so many people have, not just in Queens, but across the country, that even if it had happened 2 years ago, I would have been living in a studio apartment in Philly. I would have been a resident in the hospital with very little time, little resources to, you know, go out there and help him. You know, he would have had to really battle this disease alone. So I think like even after you take just the privilege of being able to self-isolate, if you become exposed, you know, or, you know, having access to healthy meals as your body fights the disease, you still have a lot of access issues to doctors, you know, telemedicine, you know, just being able to understand what's happening to you and your loved ones. So I think, you know, I feel grateful that I've been able to help, you know, those affected by this disease in ways that, you know, beyond what I could even imagine when this whole started. But it's not, you know, it's not lost on me that it took me and my family 20 years to build that safety net. That was crucial in my dad's recovery. And, you know, there's millions of people out there, you know, going through the same thing without, you know, going through this battle with no armor, basically.
Diana, truly, thank you so much for sharing that. And I can't imagine what it must have been like these past few weeks, attending to a loved one, being on the front line, and of course managing, you know, the day-to-day of the rest of your life, which really starts to take a huge toll. So thank you for sharing and thank you for being so vulnerable with us. I would love to know, with these past couple of weeks and the experience, you know, one foot in the NBA, the other foot on the front line. How has this crisis and this experience changed your longer term career aspirations? Do you feel that your joint background with the NBA has informed anything that you've had to do or observe differently than your peers? And how does this fit into any next steps for you?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, my going into the NBA, I knew that, you know, I wanted to continue practicing afterwards because I just, one, love what I do clinically, but also feel like it really helps inform management decisions and leadership decisions. But I also really am fascinated by just like, you know, how do you manage these like large health systems, you know, and you know, my dream job would be to one day be in a position where I could, you know, help lead some of these executive teams. But I think that, you know, this has really highlighted even more, you know, the nuances of management during times of crisis. And that's something that from the NBA, you know, having gone through it, I've like, you know, thinking through it and just living it has really informed just like how I view what's happening in, you know, in hospitals and how we're making decisions. And like Anoush and I, you know, we're in the strategy implementation class, and I just kept thinking about right. that class, you know, how do you communicate strategy? How do you get people behind you? Because that's really kind of where it all falls apart, you know? And I think this also just highlighted just disparities that go even beyond, you know, just like even hospital space disparities, you know, and how, you know, what type of populations, you know, do you serve? How do you have the resources to properly serve those populations? You know, what type of financial resources do you have access to? And that sort of macro issues that deal with everything from, you know, population to like what type of insurance mix does your hospital have? And what does that mean in terms of profitability? And you're sort of having a little bit of extra cash in the bank, you know, to withstand some of these major shocks.
Sure. I mean, you started to talk about, you know, the managerial lessons that you're learning in the classroom and then sort of observing on the front line. And a lot of this is related to sort of adrenaline-filled decision-making. So how do you think personally you're able to set aside stress to make logical decisions, or how have you seen people in the hospitals do this effectively?
Anesthesiology is a really, really fascinating profession because you're kind of, the decisions you make are split second decisions, and they can be life or death. And you sort of, I guess, you train for that kind of, you know, I guess you could call it resilience. I don't know how, but basically I find that there's a parallel between being able to do that. And like you said, just sort of doing these, like being able to put emotion, be aware of your emotions as you're making a decision, but also bring in that logical perspective and that training that, or that experience that has really informed that decision-making, that data, and balancing that sort of that data, you know, those inputs, and then sort of making a decision. So I think for me, like that's always been front of mind, and just having that ability to do that. And I just try to challenge myself to keep that in mind as I move forward. So I think my, you know, decision-making is, you know, being aware of the pitfalls of my decision-making, which is sometimes I tend to be like, I want to have all the data, but that's very unrealistic. So just having a sort of rubric for like, well, what feels right? What's the right amount of information that you need to make a decision that's timely, so that you're not acting too, you know, too late.
Thanks, Diana. I think that makes a lot of sense. And one question that we wanted to probe you on, and this was sort of the entire motivation for having you on the podcast, is hearing the differentiated perspective from frontline workers. And you've shared so many vignettes and stories that I think are putting something new into society. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about misconceptions about the disease, the government's response, public policy, something that people haven't heard about as much, or they wouldn't know just from reading accounts on the news.
The punchline is that, you know, we're still learning, and this is something that perhaps is very new to people, right? No matter what you do for a living, you know, it's really hard to sort of wake up and know that that there's still a huge unknown out there, that you need to continue living your life, but you're still waiting for that information to trickle in to sort of give you a more perfect picture of life and how, what it's going to look like in the future. I think that we put a lot of emphasis on models, but I think, you know, you have to remember they're not perfect. You know, they adjust as we learn more. You know, science is what we need to go to, you know, science over politics. Yeah. I think, you know, we touched on disparities, and that's something that we need to continue talking about and really thinking about all the different components, you know, not just social, but also, you know, what are the biological components at play? How do we support this kind of research so we can really understand how different people have been affected by this disease? I think that, you know, we've seen like the best thing we can do right now. We don't have a vaccine yet. We don't have a cure yet. But what we have seen is that places that have done social distancing, you know, as painful as that is from a societal standpoint, has been what's allowed us to save lives. And even after that, I mean, as I saw with my dad, you know, even folks that get COVID, like, people need time to recover, you know, and there's a whole conversation to be had about, you know, how do you care for patients after they get out of the ICU, et cetera.
Diana, it's truly been such a pleasure and such a privilege to have this conversation with you today and to share this space with you. So once again, thank you, thank you, thank you. We have one last question from our side. And that is, you know, outside of social distancing that all of us are trying to practice, what else can Wharton and Penn students really do to help, in your opinion, with this crisis, but also for how can we help you all as frontline workers as we navigate the upcoming weeks and months?
Yeah, well, first, thank you for having me. This has been a pleasure for me, actually, and almost therapeutic. Thank you for the free therapy, I guess, to sort of talk about all of this. And what I would say is really, you know, hang tight. Be responsible, you know, continue to be responsible, continue to heed the public health advice, take care of yourselves. It's really hard out there, you know, make sure you're checking in with yourself, take care of your mental health, reach out to your friends, your families, you know, be gracious to each other, have an open mind, you know, about the many ways that this crisis is affecting your peers, you know, have empathy towards them. I would say, you know, keep these lessons. We're learning a lot about not just crisis management, but just through this crisis, you know, the interconnectedness of public health and the economy. You know, you guys are going to be leading teams in the future. You're going to be in charge of making these decisions. You know, keep all of this information in mind, because, you know, one of my favorite quotes is that, you know, economic policy is health policy. Public policy is health policy. So when you think through your own institutions, your governments, wherever you go after, like, your decisions are linked to health and vice versa.
Right. Mm-hmm. I don't want to end this episode and I don't want to end our time together, but I know we have to be mindful of your unbelievably busy schedule. So thank you so, so very much for being here with us. I know that Sadi and I have really appreciated it, and all of our listeners will too. And thank you for everything that you've done.
I appreciate it greatly. Thank you guys for taking time. Thank you for thinking of me. Thank you for making time to keep doing the podcast and, you know, thinking about how to support the community. And, you know, I think that if I had to do it all over again, I would do Wharton in a heartbeat, you know, and I think going through this has been really, really interesting, but it's been like, I've had such a great community of people, both inside Wharton, outside Wharton, professors, you know, my executive coach, Colleen. So just, you know, we're lucky, and we should be really grateful for that.
This episode was recorded in memory of all the lives that we've lost due to COVID-19. In particular, Diana's grandmother-in-law and former New York City councilwoman, Arlene Stringer Cuevas, and to all the frontline workers putting your lives at risk daily for our safety, we thank you.